This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Listen to the bite-sized business breakfast, the best bits of the business breakfast from today, Tuesday, October the 27th. Coming up a little later on, we hear from the England and Hyderabad keeper and batsman, Johnny Bairstow. He's here playing in the T20 tournament and also living in a bubble. What's it like? We find out from Johnny. We've also had a big focus on aviation throughout the show. We spoke to Paul Griffiths on the show, and that generated a huge amount of chat about all things aviation, plus work from home and the ongoing concerns of a number of major companies about staff burnout. Talking of Paul Griffiths, he gave us his time, extended time, in fact, some fascinating insights from the Supremo down at Dubai Airport. So we'll have that in all its glory coming your way shortly. But before all that, we kicked off with what we always kick off with, asking Serena. Enjoy.
Ask Serena.
With Fragoman, dedicated exclusively to immigration services worldwide.
Mask removed. Serena's with us in the studio. Hey, Serena.
Morning, guys.
Good to have you with us this morning. Okay, as ever, first order of business, Serena. People are waking up. They want to know the number of cases. And it's somewhat encouraging, dare we say?
Yeah. Do you know, I was just looking back over figures, and it really is true. You cannot predict sort of like, not a timeline or it's... I'll give you the figures. This time last week, we were looking at 915 cases that were announced this time last week. The new figures, as of yesterday, 1,111. Over the last few days, we've had 1,491, 1,359. So a drop, 1,111. But again, can't predict a timeline on this.
It's not a trend yet,
exactly,
is it?
100%. And of course, more than 85,000 tests. More than 85,000 tests conducted across the UAE yesterday. A drop there, but still definitely locating a high number of cases. So active cases, those people, individuals still being treated for the virus in the UAE, 5,004. That's out of the 126,234 reported or confirmed cases in the UAE. So quite a low number in regards to the number of people being treated right now. Three fatalities reported, 480 now. And also, we've had quite a large jump when it comes to recoveries. So it's up from the day before where I announced more than 118,000 recovered. We are now at 120,750. That's after 1,819 people recovered yesterday.
Okay, those are the numbers. Listen, big story that we're all looking at is Emirates Airline and changes to flying into Dubai. And for some countries, it looks like it's going to be a bit easier.
Yeah, exactly. So the main bit of advice that we can give you is you just need to check the updated lists. There are two sets of lists regarding destinations that you're traveling from, and this is what it is. So Emirates Airline has revised its COVID-19 PCR test requirements for passengers traveling to Dubai. So depending on where you're traveling from, you will either be able to take your PCR nasal swab test when you land in Dubai, or you will still need to take it before you fly and when you arrive in Dubai. Now, the things that have not changed is if you are getting a test before you travel, it cannot be older than 96 hours from the date of the test before you leave. Passengers taking a test before departure, you need to carry the official printed certificate in English or Arabic to check in, because SMS and digital certificates are not accepted. So let's break this down for you. If you are traveling from select destinations, there's actually 56 of them, and I'm going to mention some of them at the moment. You've got Australia, Bahrain, Canada, China, Denmark, France, Germany, Hong Kong, New Zealand, Nigeria, Malaysia, Oman, Poland, Portugal, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, Spain, UK, and select areas from the United States. You've got New York, Washington, D.C., Boston, Chicago, Seattle. If you're coming from any of those destinations, there is a total of 56, UAE residents. You do not need to get your PCR nasal swab test before flying. You can do it on arrival in Dubai. Tourists from the destinations, you still need to present a negative COVID-19 PCR test before flying to Dubai. However, this does not apply if you're coming from the UK and Germany. You have the option to take the test on arrival in Dubai. Transiting passengers from those select countries that I mentioned before, you are not required to present a COVID-19 PCR test certificate unless your final destination requires it. Now, passengers travelling from another list of countries, it is now necessary to do the two PCR nasal swab tests, one before leaving for Dubai and then again on arrival. So this is for UAE residents and tourists. Transiting passengers don't need a negative PCR test from the countries. You do need your negative PCR test, but it can't be older than 96 hours, as stated before. So the following countries, not going to read them all out, but they include Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Cyprus, Egypt, Greece, India, Georgia, Kenya, Lebanon, Russia, Pakistan, the Philippines. And for the United States, you've got California, Florida and Texas. So that's basically it.
So even for a country like the United States, it's not one size fits all. It depends on the state. Some states, you don't need the test before you fly. Others, you do.
Yeah, exactly. So just the main change or thing to note is that you need to check where you're coming from and whether you need to do the test before leaving or if it's just you can do it on arrival.
So interesting. I've got it's up on the Emirates website, by the way, and we'll have it on the ARN News Centre app as well. But reading through, and I have questions that aren't actually for Serena, they are for Emirates, to be fair, and we will be reaching out to them this morning. But fascinating to see, as you say, that the US is basically split into two lots. And my first thought was like, well, that only covers about 9 states. What about the rest of them? But I guess it's where Emirates is actually flying to and where the airports are that Emirates is leaving from at the moment. I mean, Australia and New Zealand both being on that one test list, you pretty much have to stow away in the cargo hold at the moment if you want to get out of Australia or New Zealand, I think, which is interesting. The UK is on that one test list, which is interesting to me as well. Also, home testing kits, not acceptable. Costco in the US has just launched home testing kits, $130. They'll send you a kit, you spit into it and send it back.
Yeah, actually, it's a good point that you've made there because Emirates were reiterated. So any other certificates has to be the PCR nasal swab test. That is the only one that will be accepted. Other certificates, like you've got antibody test and home testing kit, like Brandy just suggested there, will not be accepted in Dubai.
Presumably, we're going to see the testing facilities at the airport massively ramped up on the back of this. I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. was that a question to me?
There are a lot of guesses. I mean, the cost of the testing as well on arrival.
But then it's free on arrival for tourists. I know that was something that was established during your show. So, yeah, definitely it's free on arrival in Dubai.
Serena Kelly, thank you very much indeed.
More details on the ARN News Centre app.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
A big focus on aviation this morning. We've got those new rules from Emirates about testing on arrival or before. Are you a one-test person or are you a two-test person? We've also, however, got an exclusive interview with Paul Griffiths, the CEO of Dubai Airports. Mohammed began asking Paul what things were like since basically planes were able to take to the air again. What are the 5 months that we've just seen been like for Dubai airports?
Well, obviously, we've had to adapt to very different circumstances. But I think the thing is that the outlook has been quite positive. And we've known that the only way to recover is to be put a very confident step forward. And what we've now seen is more than 100 cities are once again connected to DXV, and our recovery towards regaining our place as the world's premier intercontinental hub is underway. Unfortunately, somewhat more slowly than we would like it, but nevertheless, we've adapted our business to suit these difficult times. And we're still optimistic in the long term that as half of the world's population, over 4 billion people, have been locked down at some point over the last 6 months, that when borders open and we're all free to travel again, that travel will once again regain its rightful place as the aspirational commodity that it's become for so many billions of people around the world.
Dubai reopened its borders for tourists in July. Paul's been telling Mohammed what they're doing to convince people it's safe to travel.
Well, the first thing is that we've got to reassure people that travel is safe. And actually, I think the statistics bear this out. You're far less likely to contract the virus from a journey using an airport and an airplane than you are in most domestic situations in most cities around the world. The infection rates through the airport are incredibly low. We've actually completed more than a million PCR tests at DXB, and we're currently carrying out 15,000 PCR tests every single day. So the whole process has been re-engineered to provide travellers with the assurances that they need that when they travel, we're taking care of them. We're taking every possible step to ensure that their journey is safe. And that's something that we clearly will continue to do for as long as the current situation persists.
Right. But it's also business decisions, isn't it? There are safety and health decisions. Those are paramount. But let us not forget that Dubai Airports is a commercial entity. So we were interested in the effect, the financial effect that COVID effect has had on the airports. Mohammed asked Paul what the impact's been on the ground, revenue, jobs and projections.
Well, obviously, we've had to hit the reset button on a lot of things. But I think the thing is that what you have to do is plan for the short term and imagine things are going to be pretty difficult for a while without compromising the long term aspiration. Because I think at some stage in hopefully the near future, the aviation will get back into the growth spurt that it was before. Albeit maybe with some other customer and consumer expectations that may be different. But I think we have to be confident about the future, but plan for things to continue on their slow pace of recovery for the short term. That means some pretty difficult decisions in the short term. But what we don't want to do is harm the long-term prospects of the whole aviation sector by making some decisions that we may regret later.
And Paul also told Mohammed that they'd had to be draconian in their approach to controlling costs and managing liquidity.
Well, we've been operating for the last couple of months at just over a million passengers per month. And normally at this period, we would be normally getting something over 7 to 8 million passengers a month. So that gives you some idea of the scale of the reduction. And of course, we've had to be quite draconian in controlling our costs and maintaining liquidity. And the good thing is we had quite a good first quarter in 2020. And we were sufficiently liquid to be able to protect the business going through to the end of the year. 2021, if we see a projected and slow recovery, we're clearly going to have to take some decisions to protect the business as we do go through that recovery. But I think the thing is the team are very much engaged on looking at how we might offer what is a very safe and cost-effective product for our customers to reassure them that travel is safe. We're not just dealing with a global medical pandemic here. We're also dealing with a crisis of confidence in travel. And I believe that the industry has done so much to mitigate the risk of infection and to look after people that actually this isn't about the actual physical infection risk. It's about how we move out of risk avoidance into risk management and persuade people that travel is once more a safe and aspirational thing for everyone to do.
Right. Well, the World Travel and Tourism Council have come out in the last 48 hours and said that the standardised protocols for travelling, they hope, will be sorted within the next month. And Paul is another one who says there needs to be a global approach, a harmonised approach to testing.
One of the difficulties we've got at the moment is there is no harmonized global approach to testing, quarantine, and measures to prevent the spread of the virus. And actually, I think one of the biggest problems is that people cannot afford to spend the time in extended periods of quarantine. So if you're going between two countries that require extended quarantine, you will have to quarantine for up to 2 weeks on arrival at your destination and then again on your return. And particularly in the business sector, where we are so dependent on people being able to travel to keep the global economy mobile, that sort of quarantine approach is just incompatible with that. So what we're campaigning for is for a harmonized approach where you can do perhaps part of the quarantine process before you depart on your journey and be tested multiple times during the journey, followed by a much reduced period of quarantine on arrival. That, I think, achieves the objectives of respecting people's time and giving people a feasible way to travel.
And look, he's not alone in that. That's the call that's come out from IATA. That's the call that's come out from the new boss of BA. I mean, the travel industry on that one, I think, speaks pretty much with one voice. That voice, of course, was that of Paul Griffiths, the CEO of Dubai Airport, speaking to our producer, Mohammed Suleiman. And we've got more from him throughout the show.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
So to kick off the second part of the interview, Mohammed asked Paul Griffiths, what needs to be done to get more people in the air?
Well, I think, first of all, there are so many different ways of testing. And I think what needs to happen is we need to see an acceleration of the technologies into a proven and successful set of tests that are adopted. At the moment, the tests, if you've undergone one, you'll know that they're pretty invasive. They take some time to produce results, and those results are not always accurate. We have to improve that, and I think there are technologies on the cusp of being adopted that will make testing much quicker, much more scalable, and also much more reliable. And if we can get to that point, then testing can become a very routine and quick phenomenon. And as I've already said, there needs to be some harmonization and risk-based level of protocol so that we don't have these extended time periods which are stopping people from traveling. And then, of course, the industry has taken a huge amount of measures to ensure that people are safeguarded during their journey. So if we could get those three things sorted out and harmonised with a series of first bilateral agreements between countries, and then hopefully leading to a sort of international treaty on how we test, trace, protocol, and also how we keep people safe and secure, then, you know, we will be in a proper defensive risk management phase, which I think we need to get into quickly.
Mohammed then asked Paul what kind of conversations that he's having, not only with other airports around the world, but also with the governments of other countries.
Well, first of all, we've been exploring the protocols that I've just described and talking about the testing regimes, talking about what the most appropriate approach has been. And we've had, you know, representatives from the UK government out talking about how we might take that forward. The question now is for the governments to agree as to whether that's going to be feasible. And one difficulty we've got as we see the infection rate spiking around the world, most governments are much more engaged on keeping their domestic situations under control. What we need to be able to position travel and tourism recovery is a major social and economic driver of recovery, which you could suggest is as important as keeping people medically secure. So if we can get that bumped up the agenda and get some agreements, then we will start to see a massive recovery in travel volumes, because it's the lack of those agreements that are really the major barrier to recovering from the pandemic, not just the pandemic itself.
Okay. What about the long-term impact? Paul explained what kinds of travel trends that he thinks the pandemic will leave on the industry and which ones will eventually fade away.
It depends on how long this situation continues. I mean, the social and economic pressure that this is creating for people around the world seems to be getting worse, not better. And I think the difficulty may be we may emerge in a world where there are less people able to travel because they don't have the economic means to do so. Now, I think the question for the industry is, how do we promote travel? How do we create propositions that are much more value-based than they were before? And how can we accurately predict what the travel needs of people will be in the future? Clearly, people will want touchless protocols and processes at airports and onboard aeroplanes. We know that maybe people won't be traveling quite so much, or they might not be traveling with the style that they could afford before. So how does the industry respond to that? And I think one of the most important things is collaboration across the sector is going to be a necessary part of that recovery. I mean, for example, how can we make commercially and operationally more efficient the linkages between airports, airlines, travel, retail, all of those things, so that consumers that have now been propelled into the world of e-commerce at a far faster rate because of lockdown, how can we actually engineer that predisposition towards e-commerce into the travel arena and create an opportunity out of it?
He says, though, there is an opportunity specifically for the hospitality sector to work more closely with both airlines and airports.
My view is that the hospitality sector has got a major opportunity to collaborate with airlines and airports and produce more cost-effective integrated products that will be more globally competitive. And I think Dubai is in a fantastic position to be able to exploit that because, you know, we are really, really close in flying time to so many communities in the northern winter that where the weather is, you know, pretty dismal during the winter. And we've got such a fantastic range of accommodation, attractions, wonderful beaches and guaranteed weather. We've just got to put that into a cost-effective product and get it out there as the desirable and aspirational commodity that it deserves to be.
Finally, he ended by telling Mohammed how the pandemic would affect their expansion plans at Dubai Airport in terms of infrastructure and passenger numbers.
Well, obviously, the major focus at the moment is to recover to traffic levels that we saw in 2019. And I think for the time being, clearly the focus is going to how we make our existing infrastructure more effective and efficient. And we already had a plan that was signed off last December to take DXB to 120 million, up from the 90 million passengers that we had during 2019. And obviously, if COVID-19 is going to have a longer term impact on the growth of the industry, which we don't know yet, we don't know what the long term prognosis is, that will have an impact on our infrastructure plans. But I would suggest we've got a lot to go at with the innate capacity that we just need to develop at DXB. We're already the most efficient airport in the world in terms of passengers per slot movement, but that doesn't stop us wanting to be even more efficient and also really pushing the passenger experience to the next level to make us not just the biggest airport in the world, but the best.
That's the voice of Paul Griffiths, the CEO of Dubai Airports. Extended interview with our producer, Mohammed Suleiman.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Tom Urquhart's with us in the studio. Morning, Tom.
All right, all.
Yeah, but not for much longer, because you're taking tomorrow off, aren't you? Bit of well-needed, well-earned R&R.
Yep.
Long weekend, because Thursday's a public holiday. But Brandy, I've rumbled him.
Yeah.
He said R&R, long weekend. I know what he's doing. Because there was an announcement on the Abu Dhabi Stock Exchange website 2 days ago. I was looking at the earnings for some of the big banks like FAB and what have you. And I came across this. Ras Al Khaimah Poultry and Feeding Company.
Back in business.
Big favourite of Tom's.
Boom.
What's happening tomorrow in Ras Al Khaimah? 28th of October, Wednesday morning, 9:30 in the morning, board meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Board meeting. Review and approve the minutes and decisions of the previous board meeting. Viewing and approving the independent auditor's review. I think he secretly got a job as a non-executive director there.
Do you know what he could? There's, I mean, there are some big poultry stories going on globally at the moment. There's an issue in the UK. Turkeys for Christmas. Well, not if you don't have a lot of foreign workers and they're helping do whatever it is you do to a turkey that I don't want to think about too much to get it to plucked and eating size.
And they're on diets as well. All the turkeys in the UK are in diets and worldwide at the moment. Farmers are putting turkeys on crash diets because they're worried that the turkeys that feed more than six people just ain't going to get bought. Everyone's going to downsize their turkeys. So either they're slaughtering them now.
That was the bit I didn't want to think about.
Nice and gamey, aren't they, by Christmas, that's for sure. Or they are just putting them on crash diets. Not sure which one's worse, really, but so both issues at the moment for the turkeys.
Well, 1,000 workers is what they're down in the UK at the moment, skilled poultry workers, if you're moonlighting, in order to stop, and I quote the BBC, the Christmas supply from collapsing.
Thomas, you're not really going to be at the Ras Al Khaimah Poultry and Feeding Company board meeting tomorrow morning, but we have got a long weekend and you've extended yours by a little bit, which is great fun. You've been looking at the issue of working from home and burnout in particular.
So, two stories here for you. And sort of, I think burnout is something that more and more people are getting their heads around, but also more and more corporates are getting their heads around. Story that came out earlier on this week from Unilever, the massive household giants, household goods giant, who gave all of their workers the first Monday of this month, when a lot of workers were unfurloughed back in the UK, when a lot of the payments back in the US had stopped and a lot of companies were trying to get people back to work. Unilever said, no, hang on, you know what? First Monday of this month is going to be our global day of thanks, a day of thanks to their workers for the months of pandemic-induced productivity. So successful was that, they are thinking of making it a thing. They are thinking of making it maybe once every 2 months or once every month, but the first Monday of the month, basically in light of burnout. The figures that they're working on is they reckon they've got over 200,000 staff in the US alone. That's not just their global workforce as well. Most of them have been working from home this year, but those that have been WFH have seen the average working hours per week rise by 9% working from home. Close to 90% of their employers who used to be in an office are working the same amount or more than they were before lockdowns, according to Unilever. They're not alone. Others are following suit. Smaller companies doing their bit as well. Google gave its staff a day off at the start of September. Again, people concerned about the amount of work that people are doing from home and the effects that burnout could have moving forward. So Google actually putting dates into the diary for next year already, saying that certain segments of their workforce can work from home rather than, or just take a day off. This is not a work from home thing. This is just a, you know, Netflix, baking, doing your garden, whatever it might be. This is our day to you because of the hard yards you put in. So not only are we having work from home now, we're now having off work from home as well.
a duvet day with the actual duvet that's only 20 metres away from your desk.
Duvet day. You don't have to get to, you know, you don't have to move away from the duvet. It's perfect. But it just, I suppose, spikes or gives more evidence of the concerns that corporates are having about the amount of burnout cases they're seeing, mental health constraints, the pressures that a number of employees are under, the whole allure of working from home is sort of burnt off to a certain degree, and the realities are setting in.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right, big excitement in the Business Breakfast studio, at least in my chair, because Tom is speaking to this man.
Now there's a fielder there. There is a fielder there. Oh, just always that kind of day for England. 50 comes up for Johnny Bairstow.
Indeed we are. We talked a lot about bubbles, haven't we? Those that are created bubbles, what it's like to live in a bio bubble, be it Fight Island or, of course, the T20 cricket going on here. But what's it like to live, to work, to play, to train, and then to have to perform at the very top level? Well, let's ask one man who knows exactly what it's like to do, not just here in the UAE, but also in the UK. He's England, Yorkshire and Hyderabad wicketkeeper and batsman, and a man that was on the pitch last year when this happened.
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins! Of all margins, absolute ecstasy for England, agony for New Zealand.
Yep, World Cup winner Johnny Bairstow joins us live on the line. Ever going to get tired of that one, Johnny, World Cup winner?
No, I don't think you can, to be quite honest with you, Tom. Even still now, listening to the commentary of Ian Smith, then it still gives you goosebumps and runs it down your spine and takes you exactly back to that moment. And yeah, as you say, what an amazing day that not just me, but a lot of people around the world will know exactly where they were when that happened.
The reason I mentioned that, things have changed a little since then, JB. Things have turned around, not just in the world of cricket, but worldwide as well. You are currently here in the UAE. You're playing in one of the biggest cricket tournaments anywhere in the world, but you're also living in a bio bubble. Your one day and T20 captain and good mate Owen Morgan has been very vocal about the pitfalls of working, living, training and playing in a bubble. How much sort of support, actually, what's it like living in the Bairstow bubble at the moment?
The best, oh, bubble. Well, to be quite honest with you, it has been tricky. In the UK, we had 3 weeks for a red ball camp, and then the guys went into the tests. Then there was another 2 weeks for a white ball camp, and then everyone went into the ODI. So I've actually not been home since July, I think it is at this moment in time. So, in England, you weren't literally allowed out anywhere. So you were sleeping at the ground, you were waking up at the ground. And that got quite tricky. And then here, obviously, it is slightly different here. There are areas that have been cordoned off within the hotel. So you are allowed to have a walk down to the beach, for instance. You're allowed to use the swimming pool. But even still then, there's only certain areas that you're allowed out. And like we've mentioned previously, we'd have liked to have caught up. But unfortunately, we're not allowed due to COVID and the restrictions. So I think it's going to be around for a while, to be honest with you, because the money that's within the TV rights and within the game, they're so dependent upon people not catching it and cricket being played that I think the bubbles will be around for a while.
In terms of the sort of differences, I mean, you mentioned there about being in the bubble with England teammates, and those are teammates you've built a great sort of bond with in recent years, have known from younger generations and coming up through cricket. When you get into franchise cricket out here as well, and a lot of young Indian players coming through, do different players, do different attitudes deal with bubbles better?
I think you've got to be versatile with it. Like you mentioned, you've got people from different countries coming together to play, but we're all still working towards one common goal. So finding the best way of how people work, finding the best way to work with those guys and learn about them. I mean, there's some guys that I'd never met before here that are 18, 19 years old from India, and some of the stories and experiences that they've had are really interesting. So actually just locking in and spending a bit of time with them to get to know them, because it's all about relationships, like it is with business, like it is with sport. When you get out in the middle or into a meeting or doing a business deal, then I presume it's exactly the same. You want to be on the same page. You want to be pushing things forward and working towards that common goal.
You mentioned business there. I'm interested to get this one because, JB, whether you'd be playing back in the UK or anywhere else in the world, if you weren't in a bubble, you'd have media commitments, you'd have sponsor commitments, you'd have brand commitments as well. You, like every professional player, is conscious of your brand, of life in cricket, life after cricket. Has the bio bubble taken away from that at all, or has it sort of added to it in many ways?
I think in some ways you've got to be conscious of the industries in which, whether it be your sponsors. So, for instance, the cricket industry in England, bat manufacturers, I think that with people not being able to play cricket in the summer due to COVID, people weren't necessarily buying as many cricket bats, as many pairs of pads, etc. Then going into the winter, with the restrictions on how many people you're allowed indoors, kind of puts a question mark next to indoor winter cricket as well. But then obviously you've got other commitments like you mentioned. So I think depending on the industries and the markets that those other commitments are involved in, depends on how much or little you're expected to do. But that's like anything, isn't it? We've got to remember that we're very fortunate that we've still got a job in many ways, even though we are in a bubble and it's been tricky. There are a lot of people out there that have been hit a lot harder than us.
Question, Johnny, how big can cricket get? Reason I'm asking that question, obviously you're in a tournament at the moment that is being watched by billions. This ain't your first rodeo as well. You are and have developed into a white ball great playing franchise cricket the world over. That means that more and more people are becoming conscious of cricket. Even Pep Guardiola was talking about meeting up with Virat Kohli last weekend as well, which gives us an indication. In light of the extraordinary work that the likes of Marcus Rashford are doing in the UK and the impact it can have, can we get to a point where cricket is as big as football in the UK and worldwide?
That's obviously the dream, isn't it? I think that the schemes and everything that we've got in England that are pushing towards Getting cricket out there into more of the communities have been great over the last few years, and there will be ongoing work within that to try and put cricket more into schools, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there is a stat that if you don't play the sport before the end of primary school, so for instance, if there is a child that doesn't pick up a cricket bat or play football or doesn't play rugby before the before they finish primary school, then the likelihood of them going on to play that sport later on in life, I think, is about 0.2% or something. So that's the important bit, and that's where people are trying to target. But you'd like to hope that you can get somewhere near that. I mean, you look at India, the amount of people that play cricket in India, that's their religion, isn't it? It's what they wake up for. They love waking up. They love playing the game. And it's our job to try and inspire that next generation.
Well, best of luck on that journey, JB. Latest chapter is later on this evening, right here in Dubai, 6 o'clock. The Orange Army continue their charge as well. Best of luck in that game against Delhi later on. JB, thank you so much indeed for joining us during that bubble. Keep the Besto bubble blown up and bubbling along, my friend, and we'll catch up soon.
Cheers. Thanks, Tom.
Our thanks to Johnny Besto joining us from the Besto bubble.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.